in the engagements. I lost a tank, personally, and had to get out of that and get into another one, which was, of course, the troop leader's job.
Tell me about that. What happened there?
Well, just that you're hit, and I lost my gunner. I lost my wireless operator. Both of them killed. You know, there was a hell of an explosion, and the first thing you know, I found myself on the ground. Whether I was blown out of the tank, or whether I jumped, or whatever it was, one sort of realizes you're on the ground, and your tank is an inferno. Mm-hmm. The driver got out all right, but I lost the two others. And the co-driver got out too. We had co-drivers in the Sherman. I say we lost something like 27 tanks out of our total of 60 odd on that plus one, which was a real shambles sort of idea. We had to withdraw, and we did withdraw from Buron. I got to see the Carpiquet airport, but we never got to it from a bit of high ground. We got back into the little village, the little place called Les Buissons, and we managed to hold there, and we didn't withdraw from there, and we stayed there, and we were there for a couple of days. Our infantry had been badly decimated, and we were withdrawn from there about the third day, over to the right hand side of our line of advance, and into a place called Bretteville. Bretteville-Lugelieuse, how you pronounce it. And from there we went, we changed then from 9th Brigade to 8th Brigade. And we're just sort of a daily sort of an attack and try and catch this little wood and capture this place and capture that and hang on to it until the infantry could consolidate it. And it was just a sort of a dogfight sort of idea to try and get around to the west of Carpiquet in order to come in through the airport on the side. One thing I always remember was going up to this little village with a company of infantry and noticing off in the field this haystack. And somebody was shooting at me, and I can remember we carried what they call a blanket box. Every tank had what they call a blanket. It was made of tin, same color as the tank, but it was hooked onto the back of the turret. And in there you could carry your kit and your sleeping, your bedrolls and your blankets and this sort of thing. And I looked around, I could see these holes going up the side of this blanket. I couldn't see where it was coming from. So I aimed, I got my gun to traverse around, and I fired a shot at this haystack. Well, you know, sure enough, the haystack caught fire, and inside was a German tank, which obviously wasn't very, very happy with this. But there he was, right in the middle of this field, and he was completely covered by this hay, at least much from all outward appearances. And it was sheer luck, more than good management, why one would shoot at this thing. But I did, because that seemed to be the direction in which it was coming from. And sure enough, there he was. Anyway, that's an aside.
You were telling me about Abbey and the prisoners.
Oh, yes. Well, we didn't know about that at the time. We did know that the number of our people had gone missing. We had lost a number of our officers on the night of D-Day. And it was sometime later that we found out that one of the troops, commanded by a man called Windsor, had been, in fact, captured and shot at the what they call l'Abbaye du Camp, which is just outside Abbey, and this I gather was the headquarters of the 12th SS Division, which was commanded by this famous General Kurt Meyer, who later, of course, was a war criminal and was put to death. Whether or not he, you know, it's very difficult to say whether these things should have happened. I don't think they should have happened. He didn't, I'm sure, was unaware of the fact that these people had been captured and shot the way they were. Probably some some young lieutenant or something who was trying to get information out of them. They wouldn't give him his information, and he got mad and had them done in. Something like that could well have happened, in my view. So, just about this time, yours truly got some shell or something exploded nearby, and I got my leg with a few little pock marks in it. So they withdrew me, and I went back to the leg all swelled up. God, I can remember my leg. I couldn't get my shoe on. The ankle was about that big. And I ended up in a field dressing station back in the beach. Advanced dressing station, I guess it was. And I was there for several weeks. And then I got back to the regiment again after Caen had been captured, city of Caen. And I arrived back just in time to participate, some weeks before, but we were outside Caen for a number of weeks without doing very much. This is when old Monty was getting mad because we weren't moving too fast. And then a place called Vaucelles. And I got back in time to take part in what they call Exercise Totalize. Exercise Totalize was a night attack, which was an attempt to get to Falaise. It was the first time we had used armored personnel carriers in this way. This was Simmons who had defrocked the couple of the artillery regiments, removed their guns from these SPs that they were carrying, and left just the hull and the big open turret of the tank without the turret. He had a big hole, and he put a hole. He could put, I don't know, a couple of sections. He couldn't get a platoon in there, I don't think, but he put quite a few in. So along with these fellows, we did this night attack, which started around 11:30 at night. The British came over and bombed, and they instead of bombing, there was a bomb line, what they call a bomb line, and some of the bombs got in behind, and of course get into our echelon, killed off a number of our B echelon people. The interesting thing about the night exercise was that it was a three or four pronged attack on a very, very narrow front. And I was responsible for the direction of the second from the left. For that, I had done some special training. We had gone back with signals people, and we'd trained in jeeps, and the signal would go out. They'd send a dot on that beam and a dash on that beam, and they'd alternate them to be da-dit, 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 and the intensity of the dash and the dit and the dot were the same. See? So that if you divided, went right down the angle, the center, the divide section of the angle, you were on the direction that you should be going. Okay? Well, I can assure you that we tried training this for about three or four nights, all night long on this damn thing. And the most difficult part of it was after listening to it for about an hour or more. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Whether it was daw, dit, or dit, daw, you know, it was very, very difficult to tell. But of course, the further away you got down the center, the wider the distance became between the daw and the dit on the beam, and the further it was away from the transmitter. So that you weakened the thing. Well, the idea was that, Bateman, you follow that line, and behind me I had a battalion of infantry and a squadron of tanks. I had I don't know how many flail tanks from the British 79th Division, Armored Division. I had, God knows what, there must have been, I don't know, 5,000 people died.
What was your rank at this time?
I was a captain then. And I was with a troop. I had a troop with me, and it was the lead troop. So these four tanks were in front of me. Then here I was as a battle captain, following immediately behind them. And my responsibility was direction. to ensure that we left from here at Vaucelles, and we arrived at Racancourt, which was over here, at a distance of about 3.5-4 miles, right in behind the enemy lines, completely through the enemy lines, to an objective. And each one of these four prongs had their own objectives. The idea being is that in the morning, people between the prongs would withdraw, or they would be cut off. The other aid they had to help me keep direction were Bofors guns. And they lowered the Bofors gun rather than fire it in the air. They would fire it over our heads. And the Bofors was aimed directly on the line. So that the Bofors, and about every minute, one round would fire. And you'd see the direction of this round because of the tracer. Trouble is, again, when you get out about two or three miles, the Bofors, like every other gun, keeps its direction, etc., with spin, and of course it would spin off. Mm-hmm. And as you got toward the end of the distance, just about before the tracer went out, the damn thing would veer off angle and go off to the right. So there was this problem. And then in the middle of it all, our dear friends, the Air Force, or the gunners, laid smoke down. Well, everyone's saying that this was the enemy was laying the smoke down. Of course, it wasn't the enemy. It was our own goddamn smoke. And of course, they didn't lay it far enough ahead of us, and we went into it. Well, you can imagine the chaos that occurred. I can remember coming to this little village of Racancourt, which was a mining town. I don't know what they mined there, but there was a shaft head. You've seen these shafts. It looked like a grain elevator. And it was burning at the top. Well, you'd have thought that I'd have been able to... It was very difficult to know where I was, really, at this time, and how far offline we were. Having seen this shaft head, it was on the map. But I couldn't find it. And of course, it was around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It was totally dark. We didn't dare show any lights at all. But we had a gadget which looked like a flashlight with a head on it with a magnifying glass, and you peered at it from the top, and you look, and when you lit this thing, you look at your light. But what had happened here, a very interesting thing, what had happened here is the light from this little magnifying glass rig that we had, and the color of the printing on the map where it referred to the shaft, somehow the light obliterated this. I don't know if you know what I mean. You were looking, you could see, I could see the houses, there were little squares and things, but I couldn't find that shaft. Well, you look at it in the daylight, there it was. Biggest sin. I couldn't find it. And it was because I was looking through this damn thing in the middle of the night, and it was only really the next day that I was just sheer luck that I passed by this thing. And then we arrived at our objective around 6 a.m. We got there. But I went back 2 days later along the route that I had come up. And you never saw it. It looked just like a dog's hind leg. You know, it looked like this. And the thing was, the engineers were following me. And a little man, they were pulling sleds. And on these sleds, they had lights, lanterns, which would shine one way backwards. And they were laying white tape. So that the follow-up infantry in their APCs would have no problem keeping direction. They just follow the white tape and the periodic little lantern that was shining a very low light. Well, going back over this thing the next day was the most abusive thing, really. I had hysterics to see the way I had traveled. I had pulled these people. We must have gone about twice as far as we should have. It's really something to see. Anyway, great fun. We got to our objective. It was then that the I always argued, of course, to then that we should never have stopped then, because we'd suffered no casualties to speak of. The odd tank had got into a shell hole and this sort of thing, and it got stuck. But we arrived there at daybreak, and there wasn't a sign to be seen of the enemy at all. Not a sign to be seen. So what do? We followed our plan, which was capture your objective, consolidate the objective that you had with your infantry and your tanks, and await the forces which were 4th Armored Division, which were going to go through us and carry on. Well, 4th Armored Division, to this day, I've never found... There have been all kinds of excuses made, and I've never yet seen, really, a valid excuse as to why they didn't appear until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So there was a gap here between, say, 6 or 7 in the morning, when they really should have been right on our tail and gone through till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, in the meantime, of course, the old German had gathered up his loins and had braced himself for this, because obviously he knew by then it was a major assault. Had we been permitted, had our plan been flexible enough to say to the people who had gone through there at night, carry on and go to this objective and then go to the next, I'm sure we'd have gotten to Falaise a week, 2 weeks ahead of time. But oh no, we had a complex in those days of what was called a set-piece attack. And a set-piece, you had boundaries, you had report lines, you had objectives, and you reported these things, and it was all so set that you couldn't divert, you couldn't divert from it at all. You see? 4th Armored Division was trained in this way. As an armored division, we're trained in this way, in the set-piece attack. And so were we, of course. But we had, by this time, had begun to realize, after having been the 4th Div, this was the first battle 4th Div was in, and we'd been there for a couple of months. 4th Div had just arrived over in, I don't know, a week or so before. And we had begun to realize that you had to have more freedom on the battlefield. You had to be able to make decisions quickly and to meet the circumstance. And had we done that, and had we been able to do that, there's no doubt about it, we'd have had... The success would have been just much, much more. You know, we got a gut fillet eventually, but after
Germany
terrible, terrible
consolidated their strength.
Well, then I lost a tank later that afternoon. No one was hurt this time, but they I don't know how, but it took the front end right off the tank and sort of sideways. The regiment came together for a few days, while 4 Div was getting themselves clobbered, really clobbered, themselves and the Poles, who were supposed to go through us and capture Falaise. They had a terrible time. So we were withdrawn, and we then put in another attack. Then I got hurt again. On the night of about the 13th of August or 15th of August, somewhere around there.
What happened there?
Well, then I was sent back to England. And I was then in England. I didn't get back to the regiment then until they had to, oh gosh, it was October, I guess. And I came back to the regiment, went back as a second in command of a regiment then, of a battalion, of a squadron. And I arrived back just about the time we were getting ready to leave to cross the Lower Rhine, the Nader Rhine, and get into Nijmegen. And then, of course, we were there for a couple of months. Early in January, January, February, I guess. See, the dates are gone now from me. We then crossed into Germany. And some of the little things we had to do, I can remember being called back to our squadron headquarters, to our battalion, to our regimental headquarters. The Germans were, we had captured the bridge at Nijmegen, the first bridge over the Rhine, the Waal, I guess it was, W-A-A-L. And the Germans were trying to destroy this bridge, and they were sending down these miniature submarines, one-man submarines. And they were trying to blow up, put sort of explosives on the pylons of this bridge to destroy it. And we were set up with tanks to sit along the edge of the river, and to see if we could spot any of these things and to engage them.
Did you?
No, I never. I went. If these things had been seen, I never saw any. But we went up and spent a number of days up there, alternating between squadrons, trying to catch these things, but never did see anything. Anyway, we left. We were stationed. While we were in Nijmegen, of course, the Germans attacked the Americans at Bastogne and this sort of thing. Well, it looked as though the Germans were going to get through because they broke the German, the American lines, and were heading due west and heading straight for the ports, I suppose, the Amsterdam area. Well, we were on Christmas Eve. We were withdrawn. We got into our tanks and the whole damn regiment, and we were taken back something like 80 miles to try and get into the path of where the likely path of where they were going to come. On Christmas Day, I can remember we were attacked by German fighters who tried to strafe our tanks, and as far as I know, no one was hurt. And then we, having done that, and the Bastogne thing ended, was stabilized. We were then brought back up to Nijmegen, and we launched our attack then into Germany, into the Vulcan Forest, into one of the big things about that was that the Germans, of course, had flooded the whole area and released all the water out of some dams which were upriver, and had flooded the area completely, so that we traveled from the German border. We got down and we got on a railway line. The railway line was about 2-3 feet underwater, and we took the whole squadron. I took the whole squadron along this railway line into the high ground of where did Catherine of Aragon come from? Come on now, you're a historian. What's the name of the town just outside the Walcon?
I don't recall.
The Reichswald Forest. Reichswald. Greaves? Anyway, to this town. And I followed this railway line, and I literally had people walking in front of the tanks, because the water was so muddy, you couldn't see. And these guys are walking along with sticks down, following along the railway line like this, and the tank just straddled the thing, and we went along, bang, 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 bang. Right, we went up about 5 miles this way. Yeah, really something. Anyway, we got to this town, and from there the Vulcan Forest was we stayed in the Reichswald for a week or so, and then we put in another tack south to the Vulcan. The little town called Zem, I remember, and here again, it had gates, stone gates, the entrance of the town, with one single road running into it. Mm-hmm. And on either side, there were great ditches full of water. So you had to travel on this road and get through this gate. I had with me, I had in support of me, some flail tanks. The British 79th Armored Division was a funniest division. It had flails, it had things that squirted the fire, it had things which blew up mines, and all kinds of, it had lights which would give you night light, shoot it off the cloud and you could see pretty well to move. Movement light, it was called. So I had these flails in front of me because it was pretty obvious that the sort of place where there was a narrow sort of confined space would be an ideal place for Germans to lay mines where you couldn't get off the road. So I put these damn flails in front of me, and they arrived at these gates, enormous stone thing. They couldn't get through. The flail was much wider than the tank itself. There was a big roller with chains on it, and as they went along, these chains beat the ground, and as it beat the ground, it would explode the mines in front of it. They couldn't get through these gates. So there we were, stuck at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning. This attack was planned to go south of Zanten, and so I had to order them off the road. And you never heard so much noise in your life, because they literally had to get off the road, and when they got off the road, they went down into these ditches, and these ditches were full of water. And this was a very unhappy situation for our British friends. They didn't like it at all. Anyway, got through that, captured Zanten, went south, and I guess I don't know whether we built the hawk balls was before that or after that. But we had to go through the hawk ball forest in the middle of the night again, which is a very terrifying experience. Just on one single road driving through, but we got through. That was in March, I think. February, March. The regiment was brought back then. We were getting ready to cross the Rhine. And I was sent home to take a Royal Armored Tactical course, which was people were pretty tired by then. And,
that was just to give you a rest?
Mostly, because, you know, what's the point of teaching a man tank tactics at that stage of the game?
So people in the field could be promoted?
That's exactly right. So that to give the opportunity of people to be promoted and to give the person, the individual concerned, a rest. I did that, and when I was in England, the war ended. I returned to the regiment at a place called Lingen in Germany, and stayed there for a very short time, staying in a school. And from there, just south of Bremen, and from there we were withdrawn, and we stayed at a place called Log Kapel, I think it was called, and we were there for a couple of months. One of the funny things was that this town of Lingen had an alcohol brewery, an alcohol factory, I suppose you'd call it. And one of my troops, I was a squadron leader by then, one of my troops was very clever, so they emptied one of their tanks, gasoline tanks, in each of their four tanks. So they had, each one of these tanks would hold 75 gallons, I would think. So they ended up, they brought back from Germany, from Lingen, four times 75 gallons of booze that they had got out of this place. And I remember we got back to Lahr, and I couldn't understand where the drink was coming from. So one night the sergeant major was out peering around, and he noticed one of these guys under the tank. There's a little valve under the tank where you can drain your tanks, and there he was with his big gallon, a couple of 5 gallon jug, filling this 5 gallon jug with booze. So that was discovered, and we got managed to get rid of that, but I wasn't very popular. The war was finished by then. I was made educational officer for the regiment, and we started training. We trained, and we got commandeered some of the young subalterns and officers who had a good education in maths, and we taught. We taught all kinds of things.
This was compulsory for the ranks.
This was all compulsory for the ranks, and they could choose their subjects, mind you, but we taught them whatever it happened to be, maths, French, English, history, anything at all, anything they wanted to learn of the subjects that we had.
And trades?
Some were, well, trades were, no, not too many trades, no. We weren't really equipped. We had, it's amazing that trade, for example, mechanics, you know, we were loaded with mechanics because of the tank build.
That's what I was saying.
Carpentry, none of that. We didn't get involved in that. It was merely theoretical stuff and academic arts, sciences.
There was a problem getting home.
Well, yes, we were a long time getting back. That was in the spring, summer of 45. Eventually, we were moved from the Log Kapel area to a place called Barn, which was the Queen's Summer Palace. And on the grounds of the Queen's Summer Palace was he's the president of the Bank of Netherlands or something, had this summer home. And whether it was his or the Queen's, Wilhelmina's, there was a sort of a zoo there, and it was all loaded with animals, and birds particularly, I can remember. And the regiment took it upon itself to look after these things and feed them and clean them up, and so it was quite an experience. To do that. It was an area, it must have been a good 10 acres of land. And these birds were in cages, but they were all open, you know what I mean? They weren't in cages themselves, but in large open areas. And the animals too. So that was quite an experience.
There was a story about champagne.
Oh, yes. Well, we used to send people off on swans. just for holidays, to give them something to do. And one of these fellows went off with a truck, and several, with two or three trucks, I suppose, with a company of, I think it was C Squadron, and came back with one of these trucks loaded with champagne, with I don't know how many, 600 or 800 bottles of champagne or something, which we had in the regiment, which we gave to the, when we left there eventually in the fall to return to England, we gave to the this president. His name was Totvorst Tot. I looked it up. Totvorst Tot. And he was delighted, of course. His wife was a little unhappy about the whole thing, but he was delighted. Returned to England in the, say, November of 45. We were stationed at a place called Hazelmere. And we were there until January. Spent the Christmas in England. There till January, and on the 9th of January, we took one of the CPR boats. It was a Lady Rodney. The whole regiment got aboard, this Lady Rodney. It was only a 14,000-ton boat, and it took us, I think it was 11 days, or maybe it was 11,000-ton boat and took us 14 days. It took us a terrible time. We ran into one storm after the other, and we eventually made it to Halifax around middle of January sometime.
And then you temporarily left the service?
The regiment was met in Halifax, and we took a train to Sherbrooke. One of the tanks which we had was named Bomb, which I had had early on, and I suppose it got its name from me. And it had gone through the whole war. Somehow they managed to get it back from Holland in time to be in the parade when we went through Sherbrooke. So it was around the 25th of January. The tank is a monument now, is in Queen's Park in Sherbrooke, and it still sits there. The old tank bomb. I got out of the army in at that time, and I was a major, second in command of the Sherbrooke Fusiliers. I left the forces to go back to university, and I'd been out of it then for almost 6.5-7 years, and I found life very difficult. One day I got a phone call from Director of Armour and said, look, we need people with your experience in today's army. What about coming back? So I came back, and I stayed in it for another 28 years.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss, looking back on your career in the forces?
I don't think so. I wouldn't change the time I had for one minute. It was a great life. It gave you a bit of security. I had some wonderful postings. I was posted back to England. I became the IG at the School of Gunnery in Lulworth. I was in Germany. I was the first officer back in Belsen, where we had tank ranges, Canadian Army, first Canadian officer back. I was there for a year as the IG for the British forces. I came back to Ottawa to attend the Staff College. After the Staff College, I was sent back to England, and I became the narrator for the Northwest European campaign for the official Canadian historian, Stacey. I was there for 2.5 years doing that.
Interviewing some. Quite famous.
Interviewing all the people that were involved in the last, from Montgomery, I guess, was the only one I didn't really get to see, and he was then, of course, over at SHAPE. He was the first, as you know, the first commander of SHAPE after the war. But I saw all the others, every one of them. One of the interesting jobs I had while I was doing that was that I was responsible for producing the battle honors for all the various Canadian regiments and battalions during the war. So I became a member of the Battle Honors Committee, the British Battle Honors Committee. And this involved deciding which would be a battle honor. And there are three kinds. There's the battle itself. There's an action within that battle, which is a, and there is a, an engagement within that battle. To qualify for an engagement, you have to have a company, squadron, or equivalent involved. To qualify for an action, you had to have your regiment had to be involved as a regiment or as a battalion. And to qualify for the battle itself, then if you qualified for either one of these two, then you would qualify for the battle. So that there was the Battle of Normandy. And within the Battle of Normandy, there was a considerable number of actions and engagements which we were involved. Now you could claim any one of these. And then what I had to do was to take each regiment and say, now, who was where and when? Having once decided what these actions, engagements, and battles were through the Battle Honors Committee, then you could decide who was entitled to what. Okay? Then you presented to each of these units the list of engagements and actions to which they were entitled, and it was up to them to choose. And if they thought that, such like, for example, Buron was an action that I was involved in, Ochi was an action, Les Buissons and Buisson were actions, engagements. Our regiment could claim all four of those, or they could claim only one or two, whatever they wanted to do. You could only place, however, eight of any one of these on your battle honors. So when you see a battle honor, when you see a flag, which is a regimental guidon in the case of an armored regiment, you call it a guidon. In the infantry, they're called their colors. You list the names of the battles. And you're entitled then, and this is what we went back to the regiment and said, now, these are the battles, engagements, and actions to which you qualify for. Which of these, which eight of these, yes, do you want on your battle honors?
Why would it be no more than eight?
Well, I suppose it gets out of hand then, eh? Otherwise, it gets out of hand. You see this flag here? I don't know whether that shows. Yes, it does. You can see on there, for example. Now there's the you see there's our Dino on here.
Yeah.
This is the RCD, of course, this doesn't matter. But now you see here, you can't read. No, I thought maybe you could, but you can't. See, there's the first one we got. And that's Northwest Europe and the Boer War. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then this is the second one we got, which was World War I. And this was the third one we got, which was World War II. And they've added, now obviously there's Northwest Europe on there, and Italy, and whatever it happens to be. But those are the Guido. And that's what I did for about a year and a half, which was very interesting. Following that, I became chief instructor of our armored school, and then I became the director of armor.
And then you were a colonel by this time?
Yes. And then I went off to England, and they made me the military advisor in London. So I had three postings to England in the space of a very short time. And I was there for 4 years as the army advisor in London. And then I cleared the decks.
Okay.
Called it a day.
We'll end it there then.
Hey?
We'll end it there.
Good place to end it.